It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Around Wisconsin, the State Department of Natural Resources monitors hundreds of beaches for elevated levels of bacteria. Some beaches in the state have temporarily closed due to unsafe conditions.
Coming up, we'll talk with a beach program manager about water quality monitoring and what's safe for swimming.
But first, we remember the legacy of Marquette University President Michael Lovell, who died on Sunday. Lovell became Marquette's president in 2014. Together with his wife, Amy, he worked to build resources for youth mental health and resilience.
WPR talked with Lovell in 2019 about how Milwaukee could become a trauma-responsive city and an initiative called SWIM.
It stands for Scaling Wellness in Milwaukee, and it's a nonprofit organization that's part of Marquette's Center for Peacemaking that supports people who have been impacted by generational trauma.
Here's Lovell reflecting on how community members rallied around him as he navigated traumatic events in his own childhood and wanting the same type of support system for Milwaukee youth today.
I had teachers, I had coaches, I had my friends' parents who looked after me, cared for me, made me know I was important. And, you know, I think that those relationships, you know, helped me through which were some difficult times in my life. And so when I think about individuals, particularly maybe in the inner city of Milwaukee, that experienced some of the same experiences I had or other ones experienced trauma, they may not have that network around them that's going to help support them. So I think it's very important, you know, for us as a city, you know, particularly for children, to try to develop different types of systems where those individuals, you know, do feel cared for, they can heal from their trauma, and they can lead successful lives.
Michael Lovell died Sunday in Italy after a 3-year battle with cancer. A campus prayer vigil is being planned.
Now, the conditions at beaches in Wisconsin can change quickly.
The State Department of Natural Resources works with local public health departments to monitor water quality at hundreds of public beaches throughout the summer, testing for unsafe bacteria levels.
They publish an interactive map as part of the DNR's Beach Health Database. Currently, the map shows a handful of advisories and closures, including a bunch on Lakes Michigan and Superior.
To learn more, we turn to Diane Packett, Water Resources Management Specialist and Coastal Beach Program Manager for the Office of Great Waters at the DNR. Diane, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us an update. How are beach conditions so far around the state? What do you see?
Well, I see a lot of green dots on our interactive web map that you mentioned. So we're looking pretty good this morning.
It's interesting how conditions can change so rapidly as I watch that map and update it from one day to the next. Why is that?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for E. coli conditions to change, and a lot of it is weather. So we have actually had a few more advisories and closures this year than we have in the past 2 years, but we've also had a lot of rain, and rain can cause runoff events, and that can increase the E. coli at the beaches, and wind and waves mixing up with the sand, numbers of gulls and geese at the beach. There are a lot of different factors that go into it.
Ah, so birds, runoff, all contributing to E. coli bacteria in the water. How often is the water being checked and tested?
Well, that varies by beach. And again, I have to give a shout out to our partners with the local health departments and the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene, who do the testing and analysis at the coastal and inland beaches, respectively. So they test on a tiered monitoring system based on how heavily a beach is used and what its previous conditions are as far as water quality, and also the availability of personnel and funds. So some heavily used beaches are tested as often as 4 times a week, and some, particularly in more rural areas or less used, just once per week.
I wonder, is testing pretty straightforward? Is it easy to identify E. coli in these samples?
According to the test that they use, correct. Yes, they do test. It's a specific culture test for a strain of E. coli, and that's used as an indicator of other pathogens or bacteria that could cause illness in the water, because there are a number of things, and you can't test for everything.
You can't test for everything, but E. coli is a good indication that other contaminants could also be there as well. So is this happening at, like, you know, lots of lakes around and around Wisconsin? What, you know, what are you trying to orchestrate here for people who want to go to a beach?
Well, what we do is help administer a statewide program, especially for coastal beaches, because we get funding from EPA's Beach Environmental and Coastal Health Act to fund testing with coastal health departments, and also funding from other sources for inland lakes. So we have 197 coastal beaches on our beach list, and we're monitoring at 120 of them this year. And then, of course, there are thousands of lakes in Wisconsin, so we can't test them all. But we have beaches at 30 beaches at state parks and forest, and around 100 that local health departments send to the State Lab of Hygiene. And then there are many health departments who do and fund their own testing. For example, Public Health Madison, Dane County.
You mentioned the Beach Act, the EPA Environmental Protection Agency awarding funds through this Beach Act. What do these funds do for Wisconsin?
Well, they really provide something essential, because often health departments just can't fund or they don't have the capacity to monitor beaches as often as they like. You know, everyone's squeezed for funding these days, and health departments have a lot to do, and people expect a lot. So we do the best we can with the funding that's available. It allows them to monitor beaches that would otherwise go unmonitored.
We're talking about monitoring water quality at recreational beaches around Wisconsin with Diane Packett, the DNR's Office of Great Waters Beach Program Manager. Diane, if people want the DNR to check a beach that isn't currently being assessed on the beach list, how can they let the DNR know?
Well, we do have contact information on our website at wibeaches.us, and I would say the first step is also to reach out to their local health department, because by state statute, the health departments are the ones who have the authority to close beaches for human health hazards.
So just updating the beach map right now, there are several closures on the Great Lakes. There's one Lake Michigan beach, two Lake Superior beach areas around Superior. Can you talk a little bit about why contamination could be happening in such massive bodies of water?
Well, it's that we sample at the area where a small child would recreate. So in the we go in about knee deep to sample the water. And so it's not like taking a sample out in the middle of Lake Superior. Mm. And those nearshore areas are more influenced by currents and winds, and, as we did mention, runoff from the local, you know, urban areas.
How is climate change affecting the beach monitoring project?
Well, we see a lot of storm events happening. There were a number of beaches closed last year for dangerous currents because of dangerous currents forecast by NOAA and high waves. And so as we see more increased storm events, we're expecting to see more closures for that reason. Heavy rainfall events can wash away beaches, as happened a number of years ago on Lake Superior. They can increase runoff, and they can influence algae blooms. We believe that, you know, warming temperatures are one of the reasons that one can see more algal blooms.
The Great Lakes situation, is that different at all from what the inland lakes are experiencing for their beaches?
I would say yes, because of, you know, currents, and because of the preponderance of algae blooms in inland lakes versus the Great Lakes. So Lake Superior, for example, has had more algae blooms than before, but we've already had an algae bloom on an inland lake. I think just because of, you know, the way the weather and the wind, they're shallower and warmer than the Great Lakes.
And I think it is easier to see an algae bloom before you versus you can't see what is happening like with bacteria in the water. How can we use our own senses to figure out if water is safe to swim in?
As you mentioned, yeah, that's absolutely right, that it's easier to see an algae bloom. So if you see something that looks like paint spilled on the water or heavy floating scums, things that smell really bad, you know, just don't go in there. It's also a good idea to check weather forecasts to see, you know, which way the wind has been blowing, if it can blow things up against one particular shoreline. And a lot of it is just common sense to, you know, so shower off after you're swimming. Don't swallow the water. Keep an eye, especially on small children and pets, and make sure that that they're not drinking the water if you can. I know that's hard with small children. And they rinse off afterwards.
So really paying attention to the map, paying attention to the weather conditions, knowing which way the wind is blowing, all of those factor in as you make plans to go to the beach.
That's correct. And when you get to the beach, look at the signs, if there are signs there, because those reflect the latest conditions. It's possible that people have not yet updated the map, and that they're changing signs first, or that sort of thing. So yeah, just be aware.
Diane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Diane Packett is a water resources management specialist and coastal beach program manager for the Wisconsin DNR. She talked with us about monitoring the water quality at beaches all over the state.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as people take to the skies for a busy summer travel season, we'll learn how to deal with rough air.
The key is to not become a pinto bean in that can of an airplane that can handle this and have that seatbelt on.
A veteran pilot tells us why turbulence is becoming more common. That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. High school seniors are walking across the stage and getting their diplomas, but the graduating class of 2024 is unique.
They entered their freshman year at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, meaning most transitioned from middle to high school in a virtual world. WPR's Corrine Hess and Jenny Peek spoke with some of them to understand how that pandemic shaped their high school experiences. Here's what they told us.
My name is Marian Delisa Costa-Mas, and I'm a senior at Madison East High School.
I'm Olivia Campbell. I'm 18 years old, and I live in Whitefish Bay.
My name is Aiden Mueller, and I'm a senior at Vail Phillips Memorial High School.
My name is Emily Gonzalez Rivera. I'm 18, and I live in West Dallas, Wisconsin.
I was in eighth grade when it first spread, and it was just kind of a very different experience, I would say. I never would have thought that a pandemic would have affected my education, but here we are.
Especially in the first 1.5 to 2 years of high school, it was a bit of a struggle to transition from being completely virtual in high school and having no idea what in-person high school was like to suddenly being in-person high school and having to essentially relearn everything.
Thankfully, all the teachers that I had back then helped me to get back in track, like, yo, like, this is high school, like, here's the things that you need to focus on.
Honestly, it was kind of a whirlwind. Everything was just thrown at me, like online school, having to worry about turning in assignments that aren't on paper anymore, and then having to join meetings.
It was a lot harder to make friends in the beginning because of hybrid scheduling and having to be social distance.
Not even be able to see their faces because most of the people hid their faces or just didn't turn their camera on. It was a little weird, but once sophomore year hit, that's when people were coming back into school in person.
My ability to socialize was extremely impacted because I had no chance to really socialize with anybody outside of my family, whom I lived with, and friends online.
So in middle school, I used to be a very social person. So obviously during COVID, I didn't talk to nobody and I lost all those skills. And coming back, it was like awkward. Like, what do I even talk about anymore?
So I think it posed an extra challenge going into a new school where I didn't know as many people and trying to meet new people.
I didn't have experiences like meeting new people very much, which was, I think, detrimental in later years when I needed to expand my social horizons and I had no idea how.
I played a sport at the beginning of high school and that really helped me find new friends because those still continued even throughout COVID.
I've definitely improved vastly since sophomore year. And yeah, it just took a lot of practice and patience with myself, I think.
It was all just kind of a very different experience that I was very afraid of. But then once I got into the hang of it and I was able to just understand what was going on, that's when I was like, okay, like I think I got this.
It definitely taught me how to be more outgoing and to be able to try and connect with people even when there is a distance barrier or when we all have masks on.
Going back to like just staying home and be stuck at home made me realize how grateful I am to be out there in the world and to take advantage of all those opportunities that are out there.
Being shut in and having to do everything online, I think that's definitely shaped both my experience and just the general experience of this generation. You know, we have, everything's a lot more internet focused. It's kind of weaning off that a little bit, but still it's, you know, it has forever changed how we learn and how we communicate.
That was Mary Angeles Acosta Mas, Olivia Campbell, Aiden Mueller, and Emily Gonzalez Rivera. They talked to WPR's Corrine Hess and Jenny Peek about how the COVID-19 pandemic shaped their high school experiences.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Anyone who's flown probably knows this terrifying scenario. The seatbelt light flashes and the plane begins to shake and shimmy.
Hold on to your drinks. Remain seated with your seatbelt fastened. We've hit some turbulence. Usually it's a minor, if terrifying, part of travel.
But last month, severe turbulence was blamed in the death of a 73-year-old air traveler on a flight from London to Singapore. Dozens of other passengers were injured. Thankfully, though, turbulence is rarely life-threatening.
But scientists report that turbulence is getting more common and intense due to climate change. We explore what it's like to be in the captain's seat through rough air. Captain Dennis Tager is a veteran pilot for American Airlines based in Chicago and a spokesman for the union that represents its pilots. Captain Tager, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you. Let's talk about the weather.
Let's talk about turbulence. It can feel like just a few bumps in the flight, but it can also be quite violent and terrifying as a passenger. How scary is it for you as a pilot to encounter heavy turbulence?
Well, scary isn't the word. It's something that we know that the aircraft are designed in a way that endures turbulence that is beyond your wildest imagination. The key is to not become a pinto bean in that can of an airplane that can handle this and have that seatbelt on. We got a lot more going for us nowadays with technology, but the most critical piece of technology is that seatbelt connected to you. If the airplane can handle it and you're attached to the airplane, it's going to be unnerving, but you're going to come out of it unharmed and maybe just have a story to tell versus a hospital visit.
Is it more difficult at all to control a plane when you're flying through turbulence?
It can be. In what we call light to moderate turbulence, moderate is uncomfortable. Everyone knows it. Maybe the captain comes on and says, hey, the ride's going to be uncomfortable here for a little bit. It's the severe turbulence that can cause the aircraft to have difficulty maintaining airspeed. I've been in severe turbulence. I've been fortunate that no one was injured, but airspeed can accelerate and drop off. These are these massive gusts of wind created by a variety of things, depending on the situation. So the bottom line is that the severe turbulence situation that I recall most vividly was we lost about 20 knots of airspeed at altitude at 35,000 feet. That's a lot of airspeed to lose. So not only were we dealing with the severe turbulence and the shock and awe of that, because it was not expected. We don't fly into that type of air knowingly. We had to maintain the airspeed on the aircraft so that we didn't stall. So we had a pretty quick descent and got the airspeed back in line while we were basically escaping the severe turbulence. But that's the most critical threat to an airplane in severe turbulence, is the loss or massive gain of airspeed, which can cause the aircraft, while being held together structurally, you've got to man the controls and effectively fly it through that that break in smooth air.
As we talk about speed, I'm thinking earlier this year as the American Airlines plane hit a speed record of 840 miles an hour. And I'm just wondering about jet streams and tailwinds pushing planes at higher speeds. Does a plane's speed affect the way it responds to turbulence?
And what you're referencing is ground speed, something that's up in the air. If there's a tailwind relative to the ground, it's going to show you're moving across the ground very fast, or the opposite if it's a headwind. The aircraft really doesn't care what your ground speed is. It just cares what the airspeed is, the air over the wing. That's what creates the scientific, not the miracle, but the science of flight. However, those very strong jet streams, which we see, and clearly you can debate the reason as to why the weather is the way it is, the source of it can be a political debate. But the bottom line is, for pilots, we know that the weather systems are more powerful and are more frequent. So when these jet streams happen along the edges of it, if you're not sure how air works, think about water. Very fast moving water along the edges where it's not as fast, you're going to have these eddies, this disruption in the air. It's just like that. And we are trained, we have technology to manage that, to look at the predictive nature of it, and also live reports. So it all comes into the aviation space, which is ever changing. And it behooves us to be ever learning and ensuring that we're keeping people safe.
Yes. What is the communication around turbulence in your circles of pilots and air traffic control? I mean, how is turbulence monitored and measured?
I've been doing this for over three decades. It's changed. I don't even have a metaphor. It's it's literally a completely different world. The predictive ability based on actual reports and then overlaid into the models is extraordinary. On top of that, and most importantly now, I literally have an iPad app that is like a crowdsourcing for all aircraft. Imagine if you had your iPad in a holder in your car and you're going over potholes. It sends a signal to everybody else on the road, don't take the left lane. We have that on the airplanes. Other airlines have it as well. I use it all the time. I used it yesterday. And I can literally see live where there might be a tunnel of smooth air to descend through as we come into, say, Chicago O'Hare or Madison, Wisconsin. It's extraordinary. It does not take away the seriousness of respecting Mother Nature, because surprises can happen. It can change in minutes, but it gives us an idea of what others are seeing, feeling minutes before us, both in altitude and in the lateral and left and right. So our awareness, our technology, the science behind it, and people just wearing their seatbelt, you can get through a flight. And if you have severe turbulence, let it just be an unnerving story you tell at the dinner table, not from your hospital bed. And a seatbelt makes that difference.
Some scientists believe that turbulence is getting worse. And there's a researcher in England expecting clear air turbulence, which is found at high altitudes, that could triple by the end of the century. From your decades of experience, does turbulence appear to be increasing?
Absolutely. You mentioned clear air turbulence. The definition of that is when there's no other convective, no thunderstorms around the area. You know, that exists. Mountains can help cause that. They can actually have mountain wave. Think of this. You're at 30,000 feet and going over the Rockies. If there's a heavy jet stream, like the water, it's going over the rock, can cause types of turbulence called mountain wave. But clear air turbulence certainly is on the increase in intensity and frequency. The air around a storm just flew around a big storm around Dallas, and we were 40 miles away from that storm, clear air throughout the windshield. Off to the right, a big storm radar showing us, onboard radar showing us where it was and where the turbulent air was within that storm. But there was still a burble from that storm that led to seatbelts on and a please remain in your seat. Not a severe turbulence event, but we were in the clear air. So it's all of that aggregated together. And yes, it's more powerful. Yes, it's more frequent. Is this a cycle of the globe? Is this something else going on that we can, you know, talk? You can talk about in other shows. As pilots, we don't really care why. We just care how do we deal with it and how do we keep people safe.
We are talking with Captain Dennis Tager, a veteran pilot for American Airlines based in Chicago, and looking at all of the different aspects of turbulence, how it happens. Captain Tager, is turbulence influenced whether you're flying over Wisconsin or any other parts of the country or world for that matter? You know, is it any different from one place to another?
It is. It's always been. There are certain areas that have more activity and depending on, you know, how our blue marble turns and its seasons. But I have noticed, and I don't have the data other than my life experience in this and most recently, right on through southeast Wisconsin. Anybody listening here knows the storms have rolled through on a northeast vector and built up at a rate and an intensity and frequency that I have not seen in a long time, particularly this spring. Down in Texas and in that area, there's been just it's a factory of intense storms and winds. For instance, down in Dallas, they had winds up to 80 miles per hour. We had an airplane that was on the jet bridge, brakes parked, and got blown sideways. I've not seen that before unless someone's out there covering a hurricane. So, it seems to be happening in certain regions more frequently. You know, a scientist could explain why that's accurate or what making that happen, or perhaps it's just an anecdotal misread. The bottom line is when I'm on the airplane, I'm not thinking about why, I'm thinking about how do I keep my people safe. And by the way, for many folks who think, well, can't you just go above it? It looks clear now. We know where the storms are likely to build. And if they're building low and they seem like we can just go over that, those storms build at 6,000 feet per minute. May not mean a lot to you, but an airplane doesn't all climb that. And by the way, as it's boiling up, the clear air above it is extremely dangerous because it has these updrafts. So I get it from passengers, you know, why don't we just go over it? And I go, well, it's not the way this works. It's great to engage, but man, we know a lot about the weather and we have people that support us, dispatchers and weather experts that add to that. And all that comes together to keep people safe, along with the airplane being built to endure things that you would never see in a normal flight.
So, Captain Tager, what protocols do you follow when you encounter turbulence?
Yeah, we actually have particular airspeeds when we know the ride is going to be more difficult. It's manufacturer guided. And if you think of it, you know, and you have potholes on the highway, you know, let's go right up to the speed limit. You reduce your speed. It helps ease the bumps. That's been around for a long time. But one of the most important things, I'm going to say this to get attention, is to not have that seatbelt on. What does that mean? It means that when you don't need the seatbelt sign on, that sign should come off. You should always wear your seatbelt when you're seated because things change quickly. But what we've learned over the years is that if the seatbelt sign is on all the time and you're in smooth air, it normalizes that it's on all the time. Hey, I've got to use the restroom. I'm just going to get up and go. So we have changed the way we communicate that seatbelt sign. We fight to get that sign off so that it means something when it's on.
What about babies in laps? How do you keep them safe?
Babies in laps, that's a commonly discussed item in safety. Flight attendant unions bring it up frequently because they're right there. I don't have an answer. Certainly a car seat is a better way to go. They're strapped in.
In terms of the plane itself, as we see older and older planes flying through turbulence, are there any concerns there with the wear and tear on the planes themselves?
No, not on its face. I know what you're getting at. You know, the older the airplane, like the car, maybe it doesn't endure the turbulence as well. As long as the airplane is maintained and properly inspected, not just a quick look over, but, and I'm not just talking about after a severe turbulence event, because it's mandated after an event like that, an airplane must be inspected. And that often takes it out of service. It grounds it for a short period of time. But the ongoing maintenance, we are flying older airplanes longer because companies like Boeing are not delivering the new ones to us. So it's incumbent on the airlines and the FAA to ensure that these older airplanes are regularly inspected to the depth that matches their age.
Do they need to be made with stronger parts, more durable, to deal with a longer lifespan and then growing severity of turbulence?
I think they're made strong enough now, but they've got to be maintained. And you can't just fly an airplane for several decades and do a quick brush over check. They do have heavier checks. Those checks are often done offshore. It's another thing we're fighting. Bring that back home. Do the detailed checks with good oversight, not just delegated review by the FAA, but the FAA actually being there and saying, now let me check what you just checked. That's something that we're very concerned about now, because the oversight from the federal government has been less than spectacular. Let's just call it what it is. It's been horrid. And that is changing now, but it's got a long way to go.
Captain Tager, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Fly safe.
Captain Dennis Tager, pilot for American Airlines based in Chicago and a spokesperson for the Allied Pilots Association.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's Pride Month in Wisconsin, and celebrations aren't just happening in Madison and Milwaukee. Find out how smaller communities around the state are marking the event. That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. June is LGBTQ Pride Month in the United States. And here in Wisconsin, parades and other celebrations of the LGBTQ community are scheduled throughout the month.
Just last weekend, Milwaukee held its annual Pride Fest, the largest Pride celebration in the state. And Pride events are often connected with bigger cities.
But celebrating Pride Month isn't limited to Wisconsin's large urban centers. It's also recognized in many rural areas and small to mid-sized cities throughout the state.
Peg Schaefer serves on the Greene County Board of Supervisors as the supervisor for District 5 that represents part of the city of Monroe. She helped with an effort to have Pride Month officially recognized in rural Greene County last year. Peg, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us, please, about last year's effort to recognize Pride Month in Greene County. How did that come about?
Well, last year, the Greene County Board of Supervisors passed a resolution designating June as Pride Month, starting in June 2023 and for every year thereafter. The way it came about is that there were increasingly reports in the media and news items about the fact that members of the LGBTQ plus community were increasingly experiencing higher rates of mental health issues and substance use disorders. And a couple of us on the board started talking about this and wanted to do something about it. And in our capacity as supervisors, we thought that authoring a resolution would be a good way to address some of those concerns. And for me in particular, you know, I thought it was important to make clear to my constituents, first of all, that members of the LGBTQ plus community are valued members of the Greene County community. Secondly, really to make it clear to Greene County employees that Greene County embraces its responsibility to ensure that our employment practices and our county work environments are free from discrimination, and to let them know, to let our employees know that we support their efforts to make Greene County a more welcoming place and to provide services to those folks who were experiencing mental health issues and substance use disorders. So in particular, members of our Human Services Department and our Health Department staff. And then I guess finally, you know, it was important to me to send a message to folks also outside of Greene County, that Greene County is a welcoming place to live and to do business. It's a great place. And we want everyone throughout the state to know that.
Peg, this resolution did pass, we know, not by a huge margin, and it's no secret around the country. There's been a pushback to different Pride events and commemoration. What mm-hmm. was the conversation like? Did it feel like you ended up in the midst of this hotbed controversial issue, or was it a civil back and forth that ultimately led up to this resolution?
As a supervisor, I received emails and a couple of phone calls from folks on both sides of the issue, folks who wanted me to vote yes on the resolution and some who wanted me to vote no. I would say throughout, you know, the discussion was civil. I was really proud of our county, our community. That the night that we voted on the resolution, there were folks who showed up who, you know, had strong feelings, strong opinions on both sides. And at no point did the discussion or the tenor in the room become so contentious that anyone was made to feel uncomfortable. And so I thought, you know, for me, it was a great example of the way that a community can come together to discuss an issue that people have strong feelings about and have a civil discussion.
When we think of a Pride parade, Pride Month celebrations, we might think of, you know, the San Franciscos and New York cities of the world, or in Wisconsin, maybe Madison and Milwaukee. Are there unique obstacles that a more rural county like Greene County might face in recognizing and marking Pride Month?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but the culture here is a little bit different from, San Francisco. I think, one concern that I heard expressed last year when we were, ahead of the vote, was that somehow a recognition of Pride Month would take away from the recognition of June as Dairy Month. And, you know, that's something that I really strongly disagreed with. I believe that here in Wisconsin and in Greene County in particular, we can be proud of our strong dairy heritage. In Greene County, we are extraordinarily proud of that, the dairy tradition. We support our dairy farmers. We encourage everybody to come and visit us every other year for Cheese Days in September. But, you know, at the same time, I think there's room for us to celebrate more than one thing about our county. We're a place that's very proud of its dairy heritage. And at the same time, we are proud of the fact that we are a welcoming and inclusive community. And there's no reason that we can't recognize and celebrate both of those things at the same time.
The transgender community in communities around the country has faced, I think, particular backlash over the last couple of years. Do you think that Greene County, whether we're talking about employees or residents, can be seen as a safe and welcoming place for trans people?
Yes, I absolutely think that is the case. We encourage all folks to come and visit us in Greene County and to live here. Like I said, I think Greene County is an absolutely incredible place to live. And, you know, I think at a time when, you know, rural counties are facing population declines, an aging population, I think we really need to approach, you know, that issue with an open mind, with a welcoming spirit, and to let, you know, we need to do whatever we can to get that message out there. That we embrace diversity, that we want new people to move into our community, and that they will be welcome.
Peg, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I was very glad to be here.
Peg Schaefer serves on the Greene County Board of Supervisors as supervisor for District 5, which represents part of the city of Monroe. We talked with her about last year's effort to have LGBTQ Pride Month officially recognized in Greene County and the importance of celebrating pride in a rural community. Now an LGBT community organizer from Waukesha joins us for a look at Pride celebrations in the mid-sized city this month and year-round. Eric Check Swanson is the founder of LGBT Waukesha. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
What inspired you to found LGBT Waukesha?
So a few years ago, about 5 years ago at this point, I was just kind of coming out of college, looking around in a very conservative area and kind of just wondering to myself, where is the support now that I'm out of school? I can see these big cities around us have these big community centers that are able to support people, but we're kind of right in the middle of them and neither of them's super convenient for people from our county. You got to kind of drive for a while. Somebody actually from one of the Madison community centers came to have a speech with our public library, and I got in touch with the person who was in charge of putting that on, and we kind of started talking about the lack of support that we see in this community. And we decided, you know what, if no one else is going to do it, we might as well be the change we want to see in Waukesha.
What did that change look like? What kind of things did that inspire you to do to create the support you weren't finding there?
Yeah, so we started off very first thing. We got a Facebook page up and running, wanted to get our name out there. The very first event that we hosted was we just called it our monthly meeting. It was a game night and it was a conversation time. It was come talk about whatever's going on in your life. Play some games if you don't want to be too deep, but if you want to just talk for the whole 3 hours, we can do that too. And that kind of has snowballed into an online community that really took off during the shutdown. We've just started doing a crafting event at the library. We run a book club every month. We just did some Pride celebrations this past couple weeks as well.
What did those Pride celebrations look like in Waukesha?
So the very first day of Pride Month, we were able to come together for a potluck at our local park. And we had a great time just coming together, eating food, being in a place where we know we're all supported with each other. Even though the weather wasn't that great, we had a really good turnout because people were just so excited to actually see something going on in the community. And then last week we went out to a bunch of the businesses in the area and handed out pride flags, rainbow stickers, anything people would want to show their support from people just walking past. And we had a surprisingly good turnout. We weren't really sure what to expect from that, if we would be turned away from everyone or if people would actually be here for it, but we actually gave out a pretty good amount of flags and stickers.
as you mentioned, Waukesha perceived anyway as a conservative community politically and in other ways as well. Have you encountered a pushback as you've started to organize these LGBT Waukesha efforts?
We have a little bit of pushback through our social media. We get the whole spectrum of reactions on Facebook. We get angry faces. We get sad faces. We get comments every once in a while. We're trying really hard to moderate that, to keep that a safe space for anyone who does visit our page, because we really want to be that positive light in the community. In person, we've thankfully been able to kind of fly under the radar a little bit of any groups that might want to cause us issues. I can't say the same has been true for some other groups in the area. Unfortunately, they have attracted some unwanted attention last year, but we've been able to avoid that so far.
Eric, are there any misconceptions or misunderstandings about, say, small to mid-sized cities like a Waukesha when it comes to the LGBTQ community?
I think the biggest misunderstanding is just that people don't expect us to be here. The past couple of years, we've had the opportunity to visit some of the larger areas and show the fact that we are here. And every single time we get the, wait, there's gay people in Waukesha. Like every single time. And even when people come to our events, they say, like, I didn't know anyone was here like me. And it can be very isolating to feel that way when people don't think that there's anyone like them around them, or even someone who's outside of the community. If they don't think they know anyone in this community, it's very easy to get isolated or just have the stereotype in your head without knowing what actual people are like.
I've had conversations in the past about, you know, a lot of LGBT communities end up in bigger cities, but there's nothing magical about being, say, gay or lesbian that says, oh, you don't want to live in a rural area, or you don't want to live in a suburb, or you don't want to live in a smaller city, right? Talk about the importance of building these places that aren't just in the biggest cities.
Yeah. So people get that all the time of the, like, well, this isn't a friendly area to you, so why not just move? But this is our area. This is somewhere that we've lived for years, for decades. We've built down roots. We've got family and friends here. And to just presume that you want to uproot all that just because someone else thinks you shouldn't be here and you should just give in to that. We are everywhere. We should belong everywhere. We should be accepted and embraced everywhere, and it shouldn't have to be go somewhere else to feel comfortable. We should be welcomed wherever we are.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Eric Check Swanson is the founder of LGBT Waukesha. For more on the topic, find more on this story over at our website. Just visit WPR.org. Want to hear a little music? If so, Wisconsin is a great place to be, especially next week, Friday.
Indeed. June 21st is Make Music Day, celebrated in communities around the state. And that includes shows big and small, from porches and sidewalks to big venues.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today next week, we'll talk to event organizers in two communities. And we want to hear from you. Have you ever participated in a Make Music event? Are you planning to perform or listen at an event next week?
Put in a plug for your hometown Make Music event. Call now at 888- 642-0232, or you can send an email to wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
I've played at some of these. It's super chill. They're a lot of fun. Hope to hear from you at 888-642-0232. Maybe we'll see you on a stage.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.